Hi, this is Pep Phelan here from the Melbourne Poach Centre. I have with me today Simone Sheriff, who is an Aboriginal researcher and academic. Hi, Simone.
Hey, Pep. How you going?
Good. Just give me an understanding of what you're up to, where you're from, and your pathway into doing what you're currently doing.
Yeah, so as you said, I'm a researcher and academic, and I work on a project called SEARCH, the Study of Environment, Aboriginal Resilience and Child Health. And I'm a Wotjobaluk woman, and my family are from the Wimmera region in Victoria. I'm currently doing a PhD looking at like healthy weight status among Koori children, and kind of what are the factors that keep our children healthy and well, and also looking at food security. Yeah, so people not being able to afford or access enough healthy food for their families. Yeah.
So it would be really interesting for you at the moment with the current rules and regulations that have been put in place around people going out and hunting and fishing and, you know, the social isolation stuff. If Aboriginal people aren't able to go out and hunt and fish, how does that impact food security for mob?
It would really impact it for many people, like, because I think there's quite a large number of people around, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people around Australia, that would get a large amount of their food sources from that way. And then there's also, you know, if you're living in kind of remote areas, it's quite difficult at the best of times to be able to get produce. And then currently it'd be even worse. Like, you look at supermarkets and things in big areas like Sydney and Melbourne, and that's even difficult. So you can imagine how much even more difficult it would be for people in remote areas. Yeah, it's a very tricky time at the moment, I think, for food security for many communities.
What was your pathway to getting to where you are now?
It's probably not a very traditional academic pathway. Yeah, so I started working on this same research project, SEARCH, at my local AMS for a year or two, and then I got offered a job in Sydney at the Coordinating Centre for the project. And so I started working there, and I'd been working there for a couple of years, and I kept going to kind of the academic events, and everyone was always like, oh, so what was your undergraduate? What did you do? And I was always like, oh, shame. I haven't done anything. I never know what to say to people. Like, I just kept feeling like really inadequate. Like, I shouldn't be in this role, because people are always like, how can you be in this research role if you haven't done a degree? Anyway, and so finally I was like, I'm going to go to uni. And so I decided I was going to, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And so I decided I was going to do an undergraduate in health sciences. And so I was like, that's it. And so I turned up to Sydney Uni to their Camperdown office, and I was looking everywhere for the health sciences building. And apparently they have two campuses, and the health science one is not the one that I was at. Anyway, so then I ended up meeting up with Professor Sandra Eads for lunch that day. And I was telling her my plan. I was going to go to uni and going to do health sciences. And she was like, oh, you've got quite a few years like work experience through like research and also working in health at AMS. Why don't you come with me, and we'll go have a yarn with this other Aboriginal academic there who runs a course. It was a graduate diploma of Indigenous health promotion. Yeah, I went and spoke with her, and then, yeah, I was able to get into that program, which went for a year. And then from that, Sydney Uni let me go straight on to do a Master of Public Health, which was quite, I don't know, I found it quite challenging. And I had a baby in between, which made it a bit harder. So it took me quite a few years to finish my Master's of Public Health. Yeah, but I finished that in 2018, and then I enrolled in a some unknown reason, I decided to do a PhD, which is something I never thought I'd be saying I'm doing. But yeah, so that's my journey to here.
So you went into a postgrad without having ever done an undergrad?
Yes.
Well, I suppose doing the research gives you a really strong foundational knowledge that's required, I suppose, to go into a postgrad and then a master's and then obviously onto a PhD.
Yeah, I think because I'd been doing like the practical side of research for a number of years, and also worked in health positions at AMS. Yeah, I think that kind of knowledge really helped me in the degrees. It was good.
What was your positions in health at the AMS?
I was a drug and alcohol worker at the AMS. Yeah. And then before I worked at the AMS, I worked in disability services. And then I was also at school halfway through year 11 and started an apprenticeship as a chef. So done a bit of everything.
That's amazing. So you started an apprenticeship as a chef. You went through, you did research at the AMS. You're working in health at the AMS. You went and did an undergrad in health promotion.
Yeah.
Then a master's in public health.
Yeah.
And then your PhD is looking at food security and nutrition. So you've basically gone from sort of the food and nutrition stuff all the way through to end up back in food and nutrition.
Yeah, no, I still love food. So I think it all fits together nicely.
How did you get interested in your particular field or your field of impact?
Yeah, so when I was thinking about doing a PhD, I'd actually had a few people offer me potential PhDs that I could do, and just nothing really kind of appealed to me. And I was a little bit confused, like, at the time, like, what I really wanted to do. And yeah, because my background kind of in chefing, and I really love food, and also, like, you know, having a child and trying to give him the best start to life and everything like that. And my boss at work, she's a public health nutritionist. And so she was saying, what about, like, using all of your kind of interests and kind of passion in that area? You could look at, yeah, looking at kind of healthy weight status and kind of the protective factors for children doing well, and also how food insecurity impacts on children's weight and health and everything. So, I don't know, it just kind of seemed to make sense to me to do it around that.
I think it's fantastic research that you're doing, because, you know, obviously the research is out there around people from low socioeconomic or oppressed backgrounds, and how food insecurity does impact them, or how the cheapest food is actually the most unhealthy food.
I think if you have limited, if you have limited money, and so, like, if you look at how much people, like, a lot of people earn, it's not very much to be able to buy healthy food. Like, it's expensive to be able to feed your family healthy food. And I think currently in Australia, a lot of the initiatives around kind of child obesity initiatives, I suppose, are so focused on healthy eating and, like, exercise factors. They don't even consider, like, can people actually even afford to eat healthy food? Like, it's all well and good to tell people eat healthy, but have you looked at, like, can people actually afford it? Can they even access it? Like,
how have your core values underpinned your work?
My core values have underpinned the way that I like to approach research. Trust is really important to me, like compassion, community, and honesty. And so I think that often you see in research, kind of researchers tend to, you know, they obviously hold the power often in research. And so research is often a dirty word in community. And so there's, like, this big lack of trust and kind of compassion, like, people are often just seen as research subjects, like, not even as human beings half the time. And so I think my approach to research, like, as I was saying before we started this, like, I don't even look at myself as a researcher. Like, I know, like, I am or whatever, but I just don't even see myself as a researcher. Like, I find my values are very different to other researchers that I work with, where they're very, very focused on the research and the research outputs. And obviously you have to, that is important in research, but I think my core values around, you know, community and trust, that always comes first before the research, and building relationships and ensuring that what we're doing is what the community wants, and it's driven by the community. And if that takes longer, then, well, that's how it has to be, I think.
Absolutely. I think it's interesting that you talk about language, and I suppose what researchers really are at their core is they're people that investigate narratives. At the end of the day, you're really an informed storyteller.
That's a nice way to look at it, much nicer than the word
research.
Yeah,
so if someone asks you from now on, you know, what are you, just say, I'm a storyteller. I'm an evidence-based storyteller.
I like that a lot.
What have you learned about influence, impact, and leadership from the work that you do?
Yeah, so I think in terms of people that I've looked up to, Professor Sandra Eades, Sandra Bailey, who she used to be the CEO of Dr. Dixon, National Academic. I feel like all of them, they obviously have their own individual traits and approach to research, but I feel like their kind of leadership style and kind of the way that they have an influence over research has been really inspiring.
What does Indigenous leadership mean to you?
Yeah, so Indigenous leadership, when I think of that, I think of a leadership style that's kind of more inclusive, a sense of community, or like a more holistic style of research. And I think that Indigenous leadership is very, I don't know, it has to be more kind of adaptable, and I feel like it's more complex. You're always having to balance this kind of fine line between both worlds. I think Indigenous leadership is more of like a consensus decision-making style, like it's kind of more community-based, responding to community needs without kind of those power driven motives that you often see in Western leadership. Like in Western leadership, there's kind of more of this kind of dictator or authority kind of figure. You know, you're meant to follow one person and all kind of follow along behind them, where I feel like Indigenous leadership is more like you walk alongside with everyone, or you're walking even from behind, leading from behind. And you also, in terms of Indigenous leadership, you kind of have to have that awareness of different leadership styles, what your leadership style would be when, you know, working in community or with communities, but then having to sometimes change that style to be able to work with non-Indigenous organisations such as government and things like that.
In what ways can non-Indigenous people learn about leadership and ways of doing, being and knowing from their Indigenous colleagues?
I think the biggest way that non-Indigenous people would be able to do that is, I think often, like too often, non-Indigenous people, you know, you need to be an active listener and give Indigenous people that you're working with that platform and that voice to be able to share it for you to be able to learn from. Non-Indigenous researchers can learn a lot from Indigenous researchers, Indigenous leaders, just in terms of different forms of knowledge and skills rather than, you know, a Western academic knowledge or skill set. Just from learning from us, that could lead to kind of smarter or more relevant kind of research, being able to, you know, value those other forms of knowledge and skills and our ways of doing things. I think it could lead to better research that's going to be more relevant for communities. And
So if you had full power over the research industry and you could transform the way that research occurred and the way it's reported, I suppose, in what ways would you do that?
Too often in research, we hear people talking about how they've kind of co-designed or co-created research with communities. And I think too often it's done in kind of a very tokenistic kind of way, and like at best sometimes they're consulted with community. And so I think that if I was able to change research, I would like to see it change, like, you know, change the way that research is even funded. Aboriginal health research money is often given to non-Aboriginal researchers to do research. And yes, they sometimes involve Aboriginal people, but I think, again, sometimes it's kind of in a tokenistic way. And so I think I would like to see, if I was in a position to have any kind of power over that changing, I would like to see it change in the way that research funding is given out, that it also values other forms of knowledge and skills, not just academic track records. It also values that other form of, you know, community knowledge and ways of doing research. And to be able to see health money going to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander chief investigators and having Aboriginal people have control and ownership over how that research is designed and implemented, how it's written up and communicated. You know, just last year I seen this research article that came out, and it was talking about, I can't remember exactly, but it was talking about how women's health issues had been misdiagnosed, misunderstood, etc., from a long history of men being in control of doing the research. And so I think it's the same in Aboriginal health research, obviously, but much different in some ways. I don't know, I'd like to be able to just have Aboriginal academics be able to get more research funding that are going to be able to work with communities, and also be able to have like Aboriginal community controlled health organisations be able to go for research funding. Because I think, too often, I think now we are in a position of power to say, like, if you want to work with our community, this is the way you're going to have to work with us. And if, you know, if you don't want to work that way, then see you later. And so I think that's really good that we have that power now to say, like, at Aboriginal community controlled health services, like, they get approached every week by researchers wanting to do research. And I think that's really good that we have that position of power now. But I'd like to see more funding be able to go to them to do research, and I'd love to be able to support them in, you know, training for their staff to be able to conduct their own research, and they don't have to have universities come and do the research, they can do it themselves. I've heard so many stories, like, working with Aboriginal community controlled health organisations on research, like, you know, they've told me stories about how they've worked with other researchers on projects, and, you know, they've collected all the data and knowledge for these researchers, and then when it comes up to the time of writing it up and communicating that knowledge out in research papers or whatever, they've been told, oh no, sorry, you can't be involved in that project, you know, you're not a researcher, you don't have an academic degree, you know. And I think that's just, it's disgusting, but, you know, they've told me, they've been like, well, you know, I think you might misinterpret the information because you don't have our community knowledge, you don't have that local context. Just because you have a PhD, that's great, but you don't have the local community knowledge and the context that goes along with that research, so you're more likely to misinterpret it than me not having an academic degree.
It's the rigidity of those Western models of thinking about what research is and what skills and qualifications are required in order to produce good research. You know, I look at Professor Paparangi Reid, and having had many conversations with her about Indigenous research versus non-Indigenous research and how the system needs to change exponentially for us to be able to get the information that's required and for people to drop the titles and the egos. And if we actually want to make a difference and we want to progress Indigenous health and other Indigenous issues, whether it's locally or globally, we need to understand there's more than just the Western way.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And I think in like it's too often that that's the only things that people want to fund is if you want to, you know, if you want the funding, you got to like do it their way.
So as a researcher, as an Indigenous researcher, what is that you love most about your work?
I don't know, I like being able to, you know, sometimes it's difficult having this kind of role as both a researcher and as an Aboriginal woman. You kind of, as I was talking about before, kind of balancing between these two worlds. And so I think that's challenging, but I also find it's really good. Like I feel quite, you know, before this, I never really knew anything about research, really, except that it was bad and what had been done in the past to us. And I just never had an interest of even being involved in research. And so I really like now being able to, you know, have that knowledge. And I feel like I have a bit of that power now because I understand those research ways and what research is talking about. And so I really, my favourite part of what I kind of do is also being able to work with, so in the project that I work on, SEARCH, we work with 4 Aboriginal community controlled health organisations. And so they designed the research in partnership with the Aboriginal Health and Medical Research Council, which is the big body in New South Wales. They designed it on their priority areas that they wanted to look at. They're doing their research, how they want to do it. And so the researcher's role is just to support them to be able to do that, I suppose. And so I really like being in this position to be able to, like I've had some of the staff at the AMSs talk about how through working with SEARCH and through working with research with me, they're being able to kind of, they called it like demystifying research. And they felt that was really empowering for them to be able to, like when researchers come to them, they now have that power because they have the understanding of like what good research is and how it should be done. Yeah, I found like that's been really great to be able to help, demystify, they were calling it, research for them to give them that power. I don't know, I feel like I've been able to make small changes with non-Aboriginal researchers that I work with, like to help them understand that there is other ways of doing research and doesn't have to always be this way. And also trying to like push back on them, like in research meetings, sometimes they constantly want to use research jargon and research terminology. And it's very,
inaccessible.
Yes, inaccessible for others in the meeting, unless you're a researcher. And so I found that really enjoyable, like pushing back, trying to challenge them about, you know, I think it's a good skill for them to have to be able to explain their research in a way that doesn't use all this stupid jargon that no one understands except for them. And also just kind of, I really enjoyed getting more people in the communities that we're working with interested and involved in and seeing how good research can be done and how that can be beneficial for their community, like them doing their own research the way they want to do it and how that has had really good positive impacts for their community, you know, in terms of getting more funding for programs at the Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Service, or being able to, you know, go meet with policymakers and discuss some of the findings that they've found. Like they were able to advocate for, like for so long, some of the communities have been saying, like, we've got kids waiting up to 2 years for ENT surgery, speech therapy, like what are we going to do about it? And no one wanted to do anything about it. And now they had this power because they'd collected their evidence showing that they needed, you know, more funding to be able to do ENT surgeries and speech. And so then they got given money from the Ministry of Health to now do those accelerated surgeries and speech, and so many children have been able to, you know, have those surgeries, and it's impacted on their health and impact on their health the rest of their life, being able to have those surgeries and that speech therapy. So I think that's been the most enjoyable.
And I suppose you've alluded to some frustrations you may have had being an Indigenous researcher. Can you elaborate on anything that is particularly frustrating for you?
Yes, as I was saying before, even the best intentioned researchers, like, you know, they sometimes revert back to doing using like jargon and things. I find that highly annoying. And just like, I've been in research meetings where they just start using all this jargon, and then afterwards I'll have some of my Aboriginal community controlled health organizations colleagues ring me up and be like, what are those research fellows talking about? What were they saying? And I'll just explain it in like, you know, everyday terms that everyone can understand. And they're like, oh, why didn't they just say that? I'm like, I don't know. Find very frustrating that I think I don't even know that I'm sure they do know that they do it, but I think some people don't realize they're doing it, but they ask you to be involved in things but as like kind of their token black person on the project or in like a tokenistic kind of way. And I think that's highly frustrating because, you know, you feel like, I don't know, like, do I not have any other skills? But so like, yeah, I have skills that I can bring to this project, and I can make your project, you know, I can contribute to the project and hopefully make it better and all of those things. But it's like, they just want you at the end of the project or the on the paper, or they want you on the funding application just to be the little token black on their paper or their thing. I find that highly annoying. And I think it's, yeah, just I think people do realize they do it. And then maybe some people don't realize they do it because they're so used to doing it. What I was mentioning before about people claiming that they're co-designing research or co-creating research with community, but they're just gone and have, you know, had a little yarn, had a little consultation, but they're not actually, you know, taking any of that feedback on board, and they're definitely not co-creating or co-designing. I find that highly annoying.
In what ways do you choose to activate your influence and leadership? How do you do it? What have you learned? What has been effective and what hasn't?
My personal preferred way of doing leadership, I suppose, is from behind, but also I like a shared leadership kind of model. And so ways I've been able to activate that is through working with some of the staff at the Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisations to be able to support. I think, yeah, it's been really nice for people to see my way of getting into academia and research, and that it always doesn't have to always be that you have to do an undergrad and you have to do this and, you know, do all these many, many, many years of degrees. And so I think that's been really nice to be able to show people that there's other ways to get into research rather than the normal kind of academic route, and also supporting them if they're wanting to go to uni, support them with that and helping them with assignments. And yeah, leadership in terms of like challenging that kind of Western approach to research among kind of my colleagues or other researchers at the university where I'm based. I like that, to be able to open up a discussion about other ways of thinking about doing things. And it's quite interesting, like sometimes I've spoken at like a forum or something about co-creating research with communities or just a different approach to doing research. And like, you have academics come up to you, like professors come up afterwards and be like, wow, that's fantastic. I'd never thought about this. Or like, how do you even go about doing this? And it, like, I don't know, to me and to us, it's probably like, you know, just common basic sense and what you do every day. But to them, they've never thought about doing research a different way. Like, yeah.
For any young or even not young, for any Indigenous person wanting to get into research, particularly in the public health space, what advice or guidance would you give them?
I don't know, like I've spoken to some young Aboriginal researchers that are working as kind of research assistants currently, I suppose. And due to like, you know, family commitments or having to travel to go to uni, it just hadn't been a possibility for them to be able to go and do like a 4 or 3 year undergraduate degree. And so I think just knowing that there's other like alternative ways to get into this field than having to, you know, it is a big commitment to do a 3 or 4 year undergraduate degree. Yeah, that's been really good to know that there's other pathways to get into that. So like I said before, the graduate diploma of Indigenous health promotion that I did is a really good pathway if you're, you know, if you've had that experience doing research. I found that a really good pathway to getting into, you know, public health, and it gave you a good foundation of all the different kind of areas in public health. I don't know, I think sometimes it seems scary to want to get into public health, but it is really challenging, I suppose, working in this space. But I think you just need to kind of believe in yourself and your knowledge and your values. It might only be small kind of wins or changes that you can get made, but all of them kind of contribute to a bigger thing that we're trying to achieve. And so I think like just not being scared to take that leap and to get into it. And
what does allyship mean to you, and what knowledges, skill sets and behaviors do you believe make an effective ally?
It's not really something that is self-defined. Like I think some people are like, oh, I'm an ally, but I don't think it's something that can be self-defined. I think it has to be something that's recognized by the people that you're, you know, seeking the allyship with. And I think what makes a good ally is that, you know, someone that is able to be, you know, have good active listening skills and listen to us and give us that platform to be able to share our voice and our views rather than kind of dominating over the top of us. And also being aware of their own biases, privileges and identity. I think too often non-Indigenous people always rely on us to do their kind of research, answer all their questions for them. And so I think a good ally would be someone that does that themselves and doesn't always expect, you know, for us to do all the hard work for them. But I think the main thing is just to, yeah, listen, take that step back and give us the platform to share our voices and our experiences and knowledge.
What do you see as the pathways forward to improving the health and well-being of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people?
In order to improve the health and well-being of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people need to be the ones leading the way, given that we need to have self-determination over our health and well-being. Being given the kind of the positions of power or leadership to be able to do that, and also the resources to be able to do that. We're not going to see big improvements if we keep having non-Indigenous people making those decisions for us, making the decision about where our resources go, where our money goes, who gets to make those decisions. I think until we have self-determination over that, I think it's, you know, it's difficult. The pathway would be that we need, yeah, self-determination. We need to be given resources, and we make the decision about how we go about doing it rather than being told all the time by non-Indigenous people how we should do it.
What is your unique vision for Indigenous people in Australia and around the world?
Such a big question, Pep. I would like to see a world where Indigenous people, you know, in Australia and globally are recognised, celebrated, acknowledged. I think that would be amazing. And also be able to, as I said before, have self-determination over our own health, well-being. I think that would be good.
Simone, thank you so, so much for having the interview with me, for sharing your knowledge and your brilliance and your insights. Thank you so much. Appreciate
all
your
time. No worries. See you, Pep. Take care.